Here we go. Hello, I'm Simon Merchant, and this is Craig, a podcast dedicated to film and music, theatre and television, anything that's been entertaining the good Steve McCabe and I lately.
And this time we've got a lot of music to chat about. That's kept us rather busy over the recent days, from Kings to Bear
We do it all here on Crave, Steve. We have indeed. And actually, you not only that, you've been really busy getting out and about and getting great photos of these bands in action up close. So you really should have a look at our website, cravepodcast.com, to see Steve's photos from all of those three concerts we just talked about. Some great shots. I see another career for you blossoming, Mr. McCabe.
You're too kind, Simon. And
apart from all that, we've also got a movie or two to chat about this time as well.
Yes, indeed. We've both been to see Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them. That's the same film, incidentally. This is the new film telling some of the backstory, the history of the Harry Potter universe. And while the title says Fantastic Beasts, less fantastic than maybe it might have been.
Yeah, and I have to say, I tend to agree. Oh, I hate it when I agree with you, but this time I think I do.
You know I'm right. You know I'm right.
I know you're right. I've also seen a film which one reviewer dismissed as a two-hour promo for McDonald's, no less.
Now, this would be the founder, perhaps?
It would be the founder. Michael Keaton plays the lead role. He plays the man called Ray Kroc, who basically built the burger empire into a global brand.
I
think it wasn't a two-hour promo for McDonald's. I thought it was actually pretty good, but we'll get to that a bit later.
Indeed. Now, we usually kick off with films, don't we?
We do, but hey, we'd like to shake things up every now and then, you know.
And let's face it, I mean, music's pretty much dominated my calendar and yours, I believe, over the last week. So I do believe that's where we're going to start.
I think we should. And the most recent of the shows that we're going to chat about was just Saturday night at Auckland's Mount Smart Stadium. A big band with a big reputation, Coldplay, of course. Now, Steve, this was another one of those shows. You were right up the front taking photographs. I think you were only there for the beginning of the concert, but still, you know, what sort of impression did Chris Martin and company make for you?
Well, Chris Martin, let's start off. This is a man who knows to about eight decimal places precisely how gorgeous he is.
Does he?
The man can mince and prance up and down a runway like nobody I've seen since Mick Jagger, quite frankly. He is energy personified, and he puts on a decent show with it. The music, I have to be honest, I am not, and I wasn't when I went in, and I remain not a Coldplay fan. There is a degree to which their songs tend toward dirgedom. They really do. There is a certain degree of drony sameness about them. Mm. Having said that, that's the impression you get listening to them on record. Live, they're a different kettle of fish. They are a very, very live band. I was surprised at just how enthusiastically they performed, just how energetically, and just how much I actually found myself enjoying them.
Yeah, actually, I'm just right now, Steve, I've got our website page open and I'm looking at your photos. And I have to say, there are several you took which shows Chris Martin exactly doing what you said. They're sort of mincing and prancing about on stage. And it doesn't look as if he's moving to a dirge, it has to be said.
No, they opened to the title track of their new album, A Head Full of Dreams. And right. They came on stage after about 5 minutes of opera music playing in the back, over the speakers. They came on stage. I didn't hear the first 15 seconds of the opening song because I was deafened by the audience around me.
Right.
This was a classic arena show. It was fantastic. I was very, very impressed. Now, as you say, I only got to stay for the first three songs. That's a trade-off we music photographers have to make. We get the best view in the house. We're right down the photo pit. I could have, had I felt so moved and didn't want to get, you know, wasn't fussed about getting kicked out by security, I could have reached out and shaken hands with Chris Martin as he tripped down the runway. We get the best view in the house, but then they kick us out after three songs. But for those three songs, I was decently impressed. I didn't get to see him at the end getting Neil Finn on stage, although we've seen that done before. That's old hat.
We have. It is. Johnny Marr.
Exactly. Yeah. That's not new. That doesn't impress anyone anymore, does it?
No.
But yeah, I was impressed with I mean, first of all, he was onto a hiding to nothing. There was no way this man was going to walk away a failure from this show. He had the audience on his hand, the moment he stepped onto the stage. And and it was a great performance. You'll notice, incidentally, that we're only talking about Chris Martin so far.
That thought did cross my mind.
It's very much his show.
And your photos reflect that, it has to be said. Has it always been to that degree, and from your previous knowledge of how this band operates?
To the best of my knowledge, he's very much the front man. I couldn't even tell you off the top of my head the names of the other three.
Okay, well, that says it all.
Exactly. But, yeah, great performance. What has to be said, though, is they also selected a very, very good opening act.
Ah, okay, tell me.
A young English lady by the name of Leanne Las Havas, who I'd never heard of before. And you came very close to hearing her on Friday night when we were in listening to Ben Harper in Vector Arena. She was playing next door at the Tuning Fork.
Oh, okay.
doing a warm up. Now this is a young woman who was originally what's the word I'm looking for here? Nurtured. There you go. By Prince.
Oh wow!
As part of a band called Third Eye Girl,
right?
And that's where she got started, but. I can't remember the last time I saw a new performer on stage with so much genuine, honest charisma and charm and presence. She's got a lovely voice. She sings jazz-inflected blues and soul. And I could have listened to her all evening.
Wow. Okay, and I've got those photos up as well, having a look at them. And you can, she has the look of a performer who has some soul oozing out of her fingertips there.
Definitely. And as the sun was setting in Mount Smart Stadium, first of all, she was a photographer's dream. The sun was just wanted to light her up. But she was wonderful to listen to, too. So, if you're a Coldplay fan, all well and good, but you need to be a Leanne Las Havas fan. She was fantastic.
Good stuff. Okay, so that's Saturday night, and that was obviously a big night. Now, we our paths did cross, although not for long. The previous night, Friday night at the Vector Arena, Steve.
Yes.
This was
Ben Harper.
Yes.
And the Innocent Criminals.
Now, I'm almost embarrassed to say this. This was the first time I have seen them.
Yes.
And had you seen them previously?
I hadn't seen them. I'm familiar with them, aware of their music, but I'd never actually seen them.
Well, I was really, really impressed. And I've got a little written summary of my thoughts on the website at the moment. But I was able to stay for the whole show, I feel very fortunate about that. And I just thought, I was trying to think of for me, what was the best word to sum up this performance of a musician who's like he's probably in his peak time. He's in his midish to late 40s.
Yes.
He's got a great band. He's lived some life. I came away thinking the word was joyous. It was just he loved doing what he was doing. The band did. It was infectious. The audience was sadly not as a full audience as perhaps it could have been, but they absolutely lapped it up. And he had I found a very interesting persona on stage, Steve, because he is charismatic, but in a particular way. He's not a huge, ostentatious showman.
No.
He's got an inner groove and an inner cool, but it's how do I put it? Slightly humble in a way for an American, a Californian. He's not – well, what I mean is he's not pushing it out there like, there's no tomorrow. He's a little self-deprecating, and he's very likable, and you could see that people were connecting with him. They kind of felt that he was one of them, and you know what I mean? It was that kind of feel to it. It was fun. It was fun. He had a wonderful bunch of musicians with him, and the music range was really impressive. I haven't listened to a lot of his music, Steve. I'm not sure how much you've actually listened to, but I was but you've got I'd heard about him being more of a folky, bluesy sort of a guy, but there's a lot of reggae influences there, some almost like just pop, and even some rock, to even almost a heavyish rock and occasionally. Just very superb musicians, passionately delivered. and with a lot of fun. And it was a, I just lapped it all up, just lapped it up. I thought it was great.
Well, I'm really glad you did. I don't entirely share your enthusiasm, I have to tell you.
Yeah.
I was down the front in the photo pit, and I looked around before he came on stage, and I actually felt a bit sorry for the fellow when I saw, well, put it this way, nobody on the floor in general admission was getting crushed. It was sparse. They were using only half the venue to begin with. They weren't using about half of the floor of the arena, and even then they didn't. So I had the feeling that they had oversold this show, and it was a shame, really. Cause, you know, he came on stage, and he and his band played what felt to me like very accomplished, very polished, very professional music. They are great musicians, but it didn't feel big enough. It felt to me like this show would have been perfect at, I don't know, maybe somewhere at the Power Station, perhaps. I thought they were in the wrong venue for the music.
Yeah, I know. I was thinking about that because we discussed this a little earlier, Steve. I wonder whether he's to a certain extent a victim of some timing here. As we're saying in our podcast right now, in the space of less than a week, there have been some pretty big musical acts coming through Auckland anyway, and around the country. And if you had some, you know, your discretionary income that you've got to spend on these things, you're going to have to make some hard decisions. And he might, you know, maybe he suffered a little bit from some people saying, I've got to go to Coldplay or I've got to go see the Monkees or whatever else it might be. Later on, Steve, it did fill up to more like, it got more than half, but it certainly wasn't to capacity, that's for sure.
Well, that's good.
But one of the things I felt developed as the evening went on was some of the characters and personalities in the band came through.
Right,
You had two in particular, a fantastic inventive, fluid percussionist called Leon Mobley, who plays the bongos just with such style and panache and an infectious personality, and people just sort of gravitated to him on one hand.
But I couldn't help but feel, though, to be fair, that putting a bongo solo in your second number was an eclectic choice.
Oh, yeah, well, I thought it sort of made a bit of a statement. You're right, wasn't it to be expected? I quite like that. Anyway, and the other, Steve, on the other sort of end of the personality spectrum was the big man on the bass.
Yes.
Who is a really big man. And this is Juan Nelson. He's a big, big guy. But, boy, he played really well. He did an amazing – I don't know if you were able to see his amazing bass solo. It was a bit later on.
No, I missed the bass solo. But
it was fantastic.
But you're right, big guy with a big groove. You could tell that.
Yeah, so he does this massive big solo in which he canvasses a whole range of different genres of playing bass, like from the slap type bass to a almost like playing a lead bass. And then he goes and stands over next to Ben Harper, and the two of them trade off musical phrases, Harper on a slide guitar, and Juan Nelson kind of imitates the phrasing with his bass. It was very entertaining and very well done. Yes, and he had a great singing voice too. We've heard Nelson, the bass player, quite a bit as well. So that's interesting. Maybe I'm slightly influenced in listening to you, Steve, that I haven't seen as much live music, certainly this year, as you have. And I'm probably a little bit – this isn't quite the right word, but I might be a little bit starstruck perhaps in the sense that it's a bit of a freshness to me, and especially if it's a band I haven't seen before.
Or maybe it's just me being a bit jaded and cynical.
Oh, I don't know. But I really did enjoy it. I thought they were very, very good. And any guy who can take his hat off and talk about his solidarity with his bald brethren.
You see, that's what this was all about, isn't
it?
All boils down to, isn't it, Simon? it's the hairless, isn't it? It's you and your anti-hairist agenda, the pair of you.
Oh, God, I've been found out.
Disgraceful.
We should just very, very quickly mention the opening act here too, Steve, because it's there's the Auckland singer-songwriter Miller Yule.
An old friend of yours.
Yes, we've spoken to him a couple of times. We've seen him a couple of times already on Crave. We interviewed him when his debut EP came out. And I went to see him on the night he debuted. It was his first time playing live with a full band. So here we are a few months later. He's playing at the Vector. I think he has been a work in progress, but he's got some talent. His band is pretty tight. It's original material. He's developing a little bit of a sort of a laid-back Kiwi persona.
Okay.
Nothing like Chris Martin and nothing like Ben Harper. It's more of a something that Kiwis would relate to. I think he's developing his stagecraft. It's still probably a way to go. Some of the songs are catchy. He's got a good voice. Some of the arrangements, I think, weren't. That was one thing I noted if I was going to sort of do a little. I'm not a music arranger, but there was a certain sameness to the way some of the songs were arranged, where you'd start off with an acoustic guitar, build it up to a big full band, drop it down to a solo acoustic guitar, and then bring the band in again. And that happened, it felt like that happened probably too many times. But apart from that, I would say, you know, it'd be really interesting to see him in 2 or 3 years down the road, got a bit more experience under his belt. If he's on around... on a tour near you, Miller Yule, I would say, yeah, check him out. You might be pleasantly surprised.
Now tell me, does he feel? I mean, as I said, I was of the opinion that Ben Harper was more of a club gig than an arena gig. Where did Miller Yule fit into that particular?
Well, that's a good point. Well, when the band kicked in behind him, they had a pretty full sound.
Oh, good.
They had the same number of musicians as Ben Harper's band.
Right.
I think they did that all right. I think the songs are, this is someone who's probably started off writing songs for a solo acoustic and is developing them into a band format. And so whether that immediately translates into a bigger venue, I'm probably not quite sure about that. But I think some of the rockier songs work better in that sort of venue. You don't want to overdo the little quiet, intimate ones, I suspect, because then you are heading back to a small club or something, perhaps.
Right.
Depends what he wants to do, of course. I mean, it's entirely up to him. But I think he's got some genuine ability, and I'd just be interested to see him, as I say, a little way down the road and see where he gets to.
Fair enough.
Fair enough.
Now, speaking of bands with questionable genuine ability...
Yes. Oh, yeah. We weren't speaking of Ben's questionable musical ability.
oddly enough, they raised the question themselves from the stage.
Ah.
Now, this is obviously the Monkees.
Yes.
They were billed as the Monkees, really, to be fair. They should have been really billed as some Monkees.
Okay. How many of the four? Well, of course, one has died. Davy Jones has died.
Davy Jones left us around 10 years ago, yeah.
Yeah.
And Mike Nesmith apparently has other commitments.
Really?
He's no longer monkeying around.
No. So that leaves Peter Tork.
And who looked for all the world like an elderly professor who just had a stroke.
Oh, dear. There's an image to conjure with.
He looked when they came on stage. He looked old. He looked tired. He shuffled onto the stage like an old man, and I completely misjudged him.
Ah, what do you mean?
He sang and he spoke and he played with maturity and age, but with warmth and with a level of energy that I did not expect from first impressions, let's put it that way.
Oh, okay.
He was clearly having an awful lot of fun, as indeed was Mickey DeLentz.
Right.
Who?
Well, you kind of expect him to.
Yes, indeed. He was clearly at his happiest behind the drum kit.
Okay.
He did play for a few songs. He went backwards and forwards. And they played a two-hour show. There was an intermission in the middle, no support act. They played a two-hour show with their backing band, including Mickey's sister.
Okay, yeah.
On backing vocals. And they played what you'd expect.
Yeah, I was going to ask you. Yeah, so all the hits.
All the hits. I mean, they came on. As they walked on stage, the theme from the Monkees was playing... And a beautiful device that they had was, as they sang and as they played, footage from their TV show when those songs appeared in the show was played on a screen behind them on the stage. And it sounds cheesy, I know, it sounds corny, but you'd be surprised how effective it was. And you know, if you were being cynical, you could simply say it was, you know, look, we're just trying to remind you, we go good once. That's if you were being cynical, but it was such a warm and such an engaging show that the cynicism just fell away. It was a really, really good, fun show. And that, I mean, that's all it ever was going to be. This was never going to be earth-shattering music. It's the Monkees, what do you expect? But when, you know, three songs in and they started picking out the guitar line to Last Train to Clarksville, how yes. can you not smile?
No. And just look, how good were their voices, singing voices?
I mean, Peter Tork, let's be honest, was never the world's strongest singer to begin with. I mean, he sang Your Auntie Griselda, which was always a peculiar song on the records. Mm-hmm. And as a result, he gave it the same degree of peculiarity. Mickey DeLenz, who was, let's face it, the best singer in the band, always
yeah.
was.
Yes.
He can still hit the notes. He can still belt it out. I mean, the man looks like a Cabbage Patch doll, quite frankly. but he doesn't sing like one.
No.
You close your eyes, you could believe it was the Mickey DeLenz of the 1960s. Surprisingly good.
Yeah, wow. Okay, well, that's good.
I mean, let's face it, they are their own tribute band these days.
Yes. Well, at least they're doing it, not someone else.
Yes, exactly, and that's exactly what everyone was there for. Nobody was there. You get a new band together and they start touring their new album, and everyone, you know, they want to play their new material, and everyone's there to hear the greatest hits.
Yeah.
And so they did that, and they did play one or two songs from the new album. Not the ones I would have chosen either. They played one called Mia Magdalena, which frankly I find to be a wee bit of a dirge. This is like an outtake from a mid-period John Cougar Mellencamp album. But it was written by your man from Death Cab for Cutie. And I didn't think it was particularly good, but other than that, you know, they played what you'd want them to play. They played a load of old classics. That's what people were there for. That's what people were enjoying. And it was.
We've been dancing nearly all night long. Come on, baby. When the music's still strong, we're doing the pony, and now we're doing the jerk. Come on, baby, let me see how you work.
Good stuff. And as with the other show, Steve, you've got some nice photos of the two on our website. Just go to cravepodcast.com and have a look at Steve's erstwhile work there. Nice. Hey, okay, so that's a lot of good music and varied music been around lately. Steve, we should just have a quick look at some movies now. And,
we should indeed. Have there been any big releases recently, Simon?
Well, the one that the biggish one is the one that is the story set before, in time, set before the hugely successful Harry Potter set of films.
Yes.
And this is Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them. And I get the feeling, it's just from your intro a few minutes ago, Steve, you were not quite as captured by this as you, at least you wanted to be.
Well, I have a lot of affection for the Harry Potter series. I remember reading them back in the 90s. I even had a book on tape with Stephen Fry reading the first book, and I remember listening to that and being spellbound by it. I like this stuff. I remember being blown away by the first couple of films, and I remember not being blown away by Fantastic Beasts.
I agree with that. Basically, I was trying to think what the main reason was for me. Can I say, this is really interesting how things can affect your viewing and your enjoyment of any cultural performance. Steve, when I went to see this, I had to go during the day for reviewing purposes. And I was in a theater where there were a couple of very, very young children.
Oh, that doesn't help, does it?
And later, a gentleman who decided to have a telephone conversation on his mobile. Mm. Add to that the fact that, and we had a quick word about this later, I found this film, I thought they'd done something to the tones of the image on screen to maybe make it look like it's, you know, 100 years old or whatever.
Right.
But for me, and either it's my eyes or the particular cinema I saw it in, it got a bit too dark at times. I was almost straining my eyes to see it.
Now, did you by any chance see it in 2D or in 3D?
3D.
Yeah, there's an ongoing issue where among a lot of very, very cine literate critics about the fact that you do lose a lot of light through those glasses and that things are dark, and they should have been compensating for that, I would have thought, somehow, but you know.
Yeah. And the other thing, just in terms of, before we get into the actual film itself, that I detracted from my actual enjoyment was the lead character, who's a very accomplished actor, double Oscar winner, Eddie Redmayne, the English actor. He had a way of talking where his voice trailed off at the end of a sentence, and I found it really hard to hear what he was saying.
No, I know exactly what you're trying to say here. I found that a lot of the way he talked was very, very mumbly and wanted to talk through him.
Yes. And I thought it might have been just me, but the other actors I could hear. So there was something about the way he was delivering his work. And actually, as the film went on, I ended up almost not listening. I found myself focusing more on what the other characters had to say than him.
It's fair enough. I know what you're saying. I mean, you're a Kiwi, and obviously your English is fairly good. But I am actually English, and even I was struggling in places to pick out some of what he was saying.
Yeah, I mean, the thing about him was he adopted a certain look, a facial expression, almost throughout the whole film, and you almost. This is very cynical and terrible thing to say, but you almost didn't need to know what he said because his face told you everything that you needed to know.
Well, that's called acting, isn't it, Simon?
Yes.
I mean, we have heard it described as the Princess Diana look.
And
I think there's a degree of truth in that. And to be fair, there was some nice physical comedy. There's one scene in the zoo. We won't give too much away here, obviously. But there's one scene in a zoo where he's trying to subdue an animal. Where there's some quite lovely physical comedy that he performs. But even setting aside the acting issues, I had big problems with the structure of the film.
Yeah, we should just very briefly explain what's going on, because there's kind of two stories running along side by side for much of the film, aren't there?
Yes, and they kind of like they threaten to talk to each other but never really do. So do you want to take one and I'll take the other? Which one do you want to do?
Well, I'll start with Eddie Redmayne's character. He plays Newt Scamander. I can't remember how he said it now, Scamander or Scamander.
I think he said it, Scamander.
Scamander. He's ostensibly the lead character here, although you could have an argument about that. But see, he's a bit, he's from the UK. He comes to New York. What are we talking, the 1920s, aren't we, Steve?
Yes.
And he is basically, he looks after and wants to protect magical animals. And So he's a conservationist, and he wants to make sure they don't get exploited, and he wants to protect them. So, and he meets what's her name? Porpentina, Tina Goldstein, I think that's the witch, who's a witch in New York. And she, in the end, sort of assists him in this quest to try and protect the animals. And that's, there are some, and because the movie's called Fantastic Beasts, and some of them do look fantastic. And along the way, he meets what appears to be a bumbling, normal, non-magician type called Jacob Kowalski, played by Dan Fogler, who I actually think almost carried the film. And so there's that story about the beasts. But there's the other story about what's going on in New York, which is a bit more complicated.
And this I thought, was by far the more interesting of the two strands. This is a very dark character, Mary Lou, played by Samantha Morton, who is heading up some organization called Second Salem, and they are rabidly opposed to the witches and wizards that they believe are at large in New York. And Mary Lou takes in abandoned children and has them lead a crusade against witchcraft. One of the children sings some very, very bleak and dark rhymes about flogging and torturing witches. It's grim stuff.
Yeah.
And there's one child in particular, Credence, played by Ezra Miller, who is a very, very deeply conflicted child who is being beaten by Samantha by Mary Lou, I beg your pardon, not the actress Samantha.
Yes.
I'm sure Samantha was very nice to Ezra, between takes.
Yes.
But on screen, Mary Lou is all but torturing Credence. And they're being strung along by Graves, who is played, quite frankly, moustache-twirlingly by Colin Farrell.
Yes.
And that storyline I would have liked to have seen a whole lot more of. And it was there was a lot going on there, and they didn't mind that anything like as much as they should.
Yes, I agree with you that they really didn't connect for a big chunk of the film. You're kind of wondering how it's all going to come together, and because of that, it left me a little bit short of engaging to the extent I would like to have.
Yes.
I mean the effects and everything are great. There is some good humour. But it's interesting that on the other side of the story, the Eddie Redmayne character and the Tina character,
yes,
are both people who are rather withdrawn and quiet, and so they're rather unlikely heroes. And in fact, we don't call them muggles in New York, but the human character Jacob Kowalski and the Tina's sister Queenie, they are much more out there and vibrant characters, and I naturally gravitated to their story more than the other two, I have to say. And so, yeah, it was a little bit slightly confusing as to what direction I was being led in, I felt.
Yeah, my sense of it was this is the first time that J.K. Rowling has written an original screenplay.
Okay.
I would suggest it probably needs to be the last.
Because
what's happened in the past is she has written novels, and these have been incredibly rich novels with a beautifully drawn, detailed universe populated by wonderful characters. And she spends way more time than would be necessary for a film, but as entirely appropriate for a novel. She spends a lot of time fleshing out the universe and developing the characters, and it gives the director an enormous pool to draw from. And,
yes,
and as a result, a director can make a phenomenal film. And...
Yeah.
And let's face it, David Yates, who directed Fantastic Beasts, he also directed the last four Harry Potter films. He knows how to make a J.K. Rowling film. He knows how to tease out the very best from her material. But this time, she wrote the screenplay, and you can tell it doesn't have the same rich depth that the original Harry Potter books had. And I think
yes,
that's a failing of it, I think.
This was an interesting point I just picked up when I was reading some other reviews, Steve. I want to know what you think about this. I think it was The Guardian, which said, oh, don't be worried about the fact that Eddie Redmayne is such a low-key, shy, apparently unheroic character, because this is just a way of turning the superhero genre, which was so absolutely fed up to the gills with, on its head. This is another way to play a hero, a hero almost in the background, which I thought was an interesting take on it, but it didn't quite work for me. It was interesting having an English character in an American setting.
I know where they're going with this one, and no, I think they're stretching.
Yeah.
I think somebody's accepting the fact that it didn't work, and they're trying to come up with a justification for it.
You might be right there. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So, I mean, it's interesting. You singled out the Kowalski character, Dan Fogler's Nomad, they call them. And, you know, it's an interesting departure for J.K. Rowling and from the Potterverse, because if you look at the Harry Potter books, the only real Muggle characters who got much development at all were the Dursleys, and they got pretty short shrift. It's interesting that they've actually got a Nomad, as they're calling them now, front and centre, and he really does carry his thread of the film.
He does. Yeah, he absolutely. He's an easy chap to like, of course, but the way he plays it. But still, he does it very well.
He does.
Yeah.
And alongside Alison Sudol, who plays Queenie,
yes,
who is Tina's sister, the pair of witches. Those two together give a lot of the light and shade to the film. Really, they make it. I don't really think that Eddie Redmayne does enough, because what I think they're doing. And you know, you mentioned the superhero films. Try this theory on.
Okay.
The way that, in the years since the last Harry Potter films, or certainly since the earlier Harry Potter films, the superhero tradition now is, you don't just simply make a film, you make a whole series of films, and the first one is the origin story. It doesn't necessarily go anywhere. It sets things up. It tells you who you're going to be seeing. Doctor Strange was no different.
No.
Doctor Strange, which did it really well, or Captain America did the same thing earlier. You know, all these films, they do this. They give you the backstory. They set the universe up, and they say, right, and now we can now start making a whole series of films with characters you're now familiar with. And I got the very real feeling that that's exactly what happened in Fantastic Beasts. We've been introduced to Nietzsche Gemünde, and so now we know him. And now,
yes.
and now the next film, and there will be a next film. Apparently, there's going to be five. Yes.
It's interesting that it's made, and not that this is necessarily an appropriate yardstick, it's made quite a lot of money, but in the hundreds of millions, but it hasn't reached the giddy heights of the Harry Potter films in its sort of box office return. And I wonder if that maybe is a little sign that people haven't quite bought into it yet, but
no,
who knows?
Because it's good. I mean, look, one last observation then. Think back to the Harry Potter films, the things I remember from them, just first thoughts that come to mind were those incredible scenes inside Hogwarts.
Yes.
When you see, the Great Hall and the big set pieces like the Sorting Hat. Those wonderful sequences, which are so beautifully drawn in the book and then wonderfully imagined on the screen. And there were glimpses of that. There were hints of it in Fantastic Beasts when they went to the Magical Council of the USA, which is the equivalent to the Ministry of Magic. There were moments when they teased at it and you're thinking, oh yes, we're back in Rowling's world here. And then they couldn't capitalise on it.
No. Well, they obviously decided not to, and they wanted to do something else as well. Anyway, it was interesting to see where the next chapter of this whole universe is going. It didn't completely sway me, but for my part, I was slightly dissuaded by the circumstances of my viewing.
Absolutely.
Never mind.
So, I mean, you say it's already sold, all the tickets. So we don't need to encourage people to buy one, but would we?
I think if you'd seen the other ones, I would say yes, because out of curiosity, if nothing else, to see where it's all going. But I probably, if I hadn't seen it, I wouldn't have cried in my milk over it.
Okay, I'll take that. Fair enough. Well,
all right.
Okay. Well, tell me about a film that you did enjoy.
Yes. Now, just a brief word about a film which I think is a film which has, I suspect, divided opinion. It's called The Founder. And it's a rather uncomfortable story of a man called Ray Kroc. And this is the man who took the McDonald's burger business in the USA and turned it into a brand and a business empire. Now, I think it was the listener, Steve, in New Zealand here, which said that they thought it was a two-hour promo for McDonald's.
Right.
I don't think it was really at all, because this chap, Ray Kroc, and we have to assume, by the way, that there's a fair amount of research and truthfulness in the telling of the story. There are some real photos used, both at the beginning and at the end. And the way some characters are depicted, they may have been amplified somewhat for dramatic purposes, but I suspect much of what we are seeing on screen is there's more than a germ of truth in it. And he basically is portrayed to be an utterly ruthless businessman.
Right.
Who stumbles, he was desperate for a break. We're talking about 1950s America. He stumbles across a single burger joint run by two brothers who are Dick and Mac McDonald. And they are the first ones to come up with a fast food option of serving burgers. He thinks this is fantastic, and he wants to build it. And he says, franchise, franchise. The whole film is about the relationship between these two men, and they are depicted as nice guys, as ethical, upstanding, hardworking business people who don't want to bow to crass commercialism, who don't want to use fake products in their milkshakes, for example.
Which is actually kind of surprising, because I noticed that Dick McDonald is played by Nick Offerman, who plays Ron Swanson in Parks and Rec. So that's a bit of a departure for him, really, isn't it?
Yeah. So if the film was centered about those two guys, it would have been a promo for McDonald's, because they come out as the good guys. But it's Michael Keaton playing Ray Kroc,
right,
who basically walks all over them. He ends up tearing up the contract, doing what he wants to do. They are distraught. He promises them huge profits and never gives them to them. And he is motivated by a desperate need to make it big.
Right.
And he will do anything to accomplish that, be it the brothers, be it his own wife. When he sees something he wants, he goes to get it. And there's a very interesting little sequence early on where he's on the road as a traveling salesman, and he's got a portable LP record player. And every night he takes out this LP, and it's a motivational record.
Oh, yeah.
And it tells him that the only thing that matters is persistence. Forget talent. Forget education. Forget fate. None of that matters. You just keep going till you get what you want. And that's what he does. And Keaton really, excuse the pun, gets his teeth into the role wonderfully, wonderfully well. You, at times you almost like him, but you spend a lot of time not liking him.
Right.
So he lets you see all that really, really well. And I thought, I was thinking, if I worked for McDonald's, what would I think about this? You know, I'd be thinking, oh, I've got a rather shady beginning to this place which I've come to work at. Perhaps
yes.
It's not a rose tinted telling of the origins of McDonald's at all. Anyway, the other thought that came to mind watching it, especially at the end, Steve, when he really starts to make things happen in the business world, is it's not that long ago, the current president-elect of the United States was chastised by some but congratulated by others in America for not paying tax.
Yes.
And I thought, well, I don't know, maybe some people look at a character like this and say, yeah, good on you, mate. You've got to do what you've got to do, and you it doesn't matter if you stomp over a few people, and other people will be absolutely appalled. And that's the story of this, and it's because of Keaton. I think it's a captivating story. It's very well told. That the 1950s is beautifully depicted, but it's a bit sad because of the way in which the victims of his path to success make you cringe a bit.
Well,
it's a compelling film.
You mentioned Michael Keaton, and I'm imagining this is the kind of role that he can do effortlessly.
It's
got his name, for as far as I can, from what you've told me, written all over it. You know, I'm thinking of characters like the editor he played in Spotlight, for example.
Yes,
this is just the kind of like I'm in charge here, I'm in command, I know what's going on kind of role. But I also get the feeling that he's the kind of actor who would bring sympathy to a character like Ray Kroc. Does he?
Yes, there is some. I think that's the magic of his performance here, because you could play this role and you just hate him from beginning to end.
Right.
But it's not quite that clear cut. Because he does give you an insight into someone who's just, he's desperate to make it big, he wants to succeed. He starts off trying to work with these brothers, the McDonald brothers. He starts off trying to get his wife to join him on this journey.
Right.
Eventually, they fall by the wayside. But he does it in a way where you see his mind racing as he's trying to decide what to do. You know, it's a well constructed performance. It's an open performance. So he takes you into what's going on. So, yeah, I'm not sure what the contenders are for Oscar for this next year, but I would have thought he'd be in the running with a role like that.
That strong?
I think so. I don't know if it's a very – it's probably not going to be a very popular movie, because it's not a very nice story, and it may not draw big crowds. But it's as an actor, I think he does a really good job. Yeah.
Oh, fair
enough. The founder. And of course the irony is he wasn't the founder.
No,
the two
he
brothers
wasn't.
Were the founder. But
yes.
He stole that title. So
now,
that tells you something else.
You said at the start of this review that it's not a 2-hour promo pitch for McDonald's. Tell us what you did at the end of the screening.
Do I have to? Yes, I do.
You do now.
Can I put this down to utterly professional research for the program?
Definitely.
I actually went and had a McDonald's.
How could you not?
Yeah, well, I did. I thought, I've just seen this. I'm going to go back and remind myself what it tastes like and go in there and just sort of feel the atmos and the vibe and can I relate to what I'm experiencing right now to what happened decades ago in the United States? It was interesting. It was an interesting thing, because one of the things in the movie is the two brothers had this vision of a kind of the thing that you hear now, this idea of a sort of a family restaurant.
Yes.
In the 1950s, it was a white middle class family.
Of course.
But Ray Kroc seized on that, and he used that idea to push and promote it. And of course, to this day, it still has that image, that's the image it pushes, isn't it?
Yes.
So, it's an interesting. It was an interesting business story. I mean, given that there was an element of dramatization, but it was. I could imagine if you were doing a bachelor's in business studies, you might go and see this film and get something out of it.
And for people who aren't doing their business degree, do we buy a ticket?
Yeah, I do. I think you do. I think you do. I think McDonald's is such a name in our landscape.
Yeah.
I think it's quite interesting to go and see how it all started. I was interested in the story and what he was going to do, how far he would go to achieve what he wanted to achieve was interesting.
Sounds like a winner, then.
Yeah, I think so. I think so. Yep. Phew. So there we are. So we've had a good run through some movies and some music, which has been very nice. Actually, Steve, just keeping up with your meritorious work on the website, there's been a couple of cancellations, sadly, in the last little while, haven't there?
One that was meant to have happened yesterday was Culture Club.
Right.
And we get press releases from publicists, obviously, to keep us up to date with what's going on. And one came through about 3 weeks ago announcing, this is big headline news, that Boy George had got his visa.
Oh, okay.
It was quite remarkable, this, you know. It's like, yeah, wow, that's big news that, you know, he's actually going to be able to fulfil his contractual obligations. And then about a week and a half ago, another email came through saying the show has been cancelled.
Yeah, I saw that. What a shame.
And that was it. I tried to find out. I tried to get information about why, and none was forthcoming. So all we know is that show didn't.
No, it didn't. And another big name, not in music, but in comedy, is not coming now.
Yes, this was announced this afternoon. And this one we do know a little bit more about, Amy Schumer, who was supposed to be playing in Auckland on December the 17th. Now, apparently, they're saying because of illness. She's not playing. Now, that's nearly 2 weeks away. So from what I can gather, they're saying that they're going to have to cancel shows in Australia, and the knock-on effect is basically reading between the lines here. This is my inference. But I get the sense that, quite frankly, you know, if you're not coming to Australia, it's not really worth coming to New Zealand. How little they know, eh?
I know. Sheesh. Anyway, okay, well, that's our loss and her loss.
However, announced but not yet cancelled is another heading we'll go with here. Obviously, the big announcement, and if you're hearing this now, it's probably too late to get tickets, but we'll mention it anyway, Adele.
Oh, yeah. Whew, man.
Who's coming, and basically I think she's moving to New Zealand at this rate.
Yes, she'll be raising her baby here.
Well, if there is one, it's not official yet.
I'm sorry.
However, she's certainly making enough money to pay for a really nice stroller.
Yes, I think so. And is this three shows and three nights? I think it's something like
three shows over 4 nights.
Four nights, okay. Yeah, I was going to say, have a little rest.
She originally announced March the 23rd at Mount Smart Stadium. That's I think it's a 40-some thousand seater or capacity venue. And it sold out in about 3 minutes.
Yeah.
So then she announced that she's playing the 25th as well, and that sold out in not a whole lot more than 3 minutes. And so now she's added the 26th.
Okay.
There was speculation that she had a fourth date, but even so, nobody else has ever done three dates in one tour at Mount Smart Stadium before. So this is kind of a big deal regardless.
Yeah, yeah. Well, she's a big name, and there'll be a huge range of people who'd want to see her, from young to old, I think.
Oh, absolutely. So, yeah, she's That's going to be the big show to be at next year, or at least one of them.
Oh, absolutely. Yep. Yes. Oh, and just
go ahead.
Sorry, I was going to say just a couple of movies that people will be quite interested to see in the run up to Christmas, Steve. It's already opened overseas, but I think we get it just around Christmas. There's quite a strong New Zealand connection. This is the Disney animated story of called Moana.
Yes,
which deals with Maui, the mythical half demigod Maui, who is a character right across the Pacific throughout Polynesia, and very strong character in the Maori culture. In this movie, it looks like it has a Hawaiian setting, but I think there'll be a lot of interest in New Zealand, people wanting to see that. And, of course, we've got a Star Wars movie not too far away as well.
Yeah, well, kind of.
Well, it's a family, Star Wars, within the family of Star Wars, but not the central characters.
It's
Rogue One.
A Star Wars story, I believe they're badging it, yeah.
So
we'll claim it's not Star Wars, but we will keep the word in there just to make sure that we still get the money coming in from it.
Yes, that's right. Yes. The trailer looks pretty good, I think. But anyway, we shouldn't judge too much by a trailer.
No, that's coming out very, very soon. Closer to New Year is the new Jennifer Lawrence and Chris Pratt film.
Passenger.
That does look good, doesn't it?
It does. Yeah, yeah. That's I'm always, as you know, a sucker for a good sci-fi, and I hope it is a good sci-fi. That looks good. Yeah,
that one really does look good. And then opening next week is Edge of 17.
Which I don't know so much about.
New Woody Harrelson film. It's set in a high school in America. It's a coming-of-age film, really. About a young woman who obviously is presumably around the age of, you know, the titular 17.
Yes.
Who is going through all kinds of teenage angst and tries to get sympathy from her teacher, played, as I say, by Woody Harrelson. Now, that one's being previewed next week, so I think we'll be talking about that.
Yeah, I like Woody Harrelson, by the way. Yeah. I think he's a good watch. Oh, yeah, okay.
And guess what is finally opening? After all this time, Sully.
Really?
Yes.
I thought it had already. Is that right?
It's finally hitting the big screen.
Goodness me, it's okay. That's a long delay.
3 months since we reviewed it, I believe.
Jeez, okay, very interesting. All right, okay, well, we've been yabbering on here, Steve, like there's no tomorrow. We must like what we do.
Glad somebody does.
Yes, exactly right. So we'll do our best to have another chat before Christmas.
Yes.
And I'm sure we can. But in the meantime, this has been Crave. You would like to get in touch with us? Yes, you would. We'd like to hear from you. You can send us an email, podcast@cravepodcast.com.
You can find us on Facebook. You can follow us on Twitter @CravePodcast.
Yeah, you're very welcome. I am Simon Mercer.
And I'm Steve McCabe.
And that's what's been entertaining us this last week.
Brilliant.